Welcome to episode 312 of The Lab. I'm Brad Barton.
I'm Phil Barton.
This is the second one in our continuing series on robotics and automation. If you'd like to hear the other episode, you can find it by visiting thelabwithbrad.com.
How many episodes do you think we'll get?
I don't know.
A dozen?
Some?
300?
Several? More than one? Less than a million?
The other episode.
Okay. I would love to have done that. I meant to do this as this really clever segue between the space stuff and the robots stuff. But then I got distracted by big beasties. NASA's Advanced Automation for Space Missions.
Ooh.
A conference they held in 1982.
Okay.
Which explored the applications of automation for space missions in an advanced fashion.
They're not very creative with their names.
I don't know when I bumped into this report. Right, but it goes on about, especially about the concept of a self-replicating system.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Where you got a robot, or a factory, and a set of robots who can go out into the world, grab raw materials, and make another factory with the same set of robots.
Heck yeah.
And I don't know, we seem to be leaning towards that with various bits of 3D printing, or what's their fancy name for it, additive something. Manufacturer.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Something like that. I'm sure there are names.
It oozes out and gets added.
Yeah. But I got a link to that in case somebody else wants to get excited. You know, all the thrills and chills of cellular automata and so forth. But that's kind of what launched me on this whole kick about, you know, because I'm not good with hardware. So I was in the software end of things and still am, which we talked about.
Well.
On Monday. Just last week. Last week The lab.
Are we doing a recap?
No, well, kind of, yeah.
Oh, okay.
We came to the conclusion after a lot of farting around with animals. I'm going to do things on robots, right?
Right.
And the first thing I do is spend a whole episode talking about animals.
Why not? Okay.
But we came to the conclusion that if you're species likes to pack in neurons with more neurons than you need as you get bigger, you will eventually get a bigger brain and be smarter.
Yay.
That being part of, not the entire story.
Mm-hmm.
I actually have a little more evidence. Let me talk about a couple more animals.
What about the robots? Poor neglected. That's all right.
What about me?
Tell me about mice or something.
If the idea is that you get a bigger brain as you make a bigger body, depending upon what rules your cells follow when doing that sort of thing, you would expect there to be a couple of species that get too big a brain at some point.
Yes.
It turns out to be true for large carnivores.
Oh, okay.
The lion doesn't have any more neurons in its cerebrum than a golden retriever.
I see a size difference here. Okay.
And the brown bear.
Mm-hmm.
In North America, we call those grizzlies.
Yeah.
It has a cerebral count. We're talking about the cerebrum specifically here for reasons.
Right.
Its neuron count in the cerebrum is about the same as a domestic cat.
Okay. Wow. That's a big animal to have. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's still a surprisingly clever critter. It's done a little bit of tool use.
Right.
Like pick up a rock with barnacles on it and scratch his neck.
They're made of claws. They got tools.
But both the lion and the grizzly bears, they have bigger cerebellum.
Oh, okay.
So there.
That's where they put all that extra. Yeah.
But at least in the brown bears, there's evidence that early in their life, they do have a brain. More like you'd expect for that size, with a larger neuron count. But then it atrophies.
Oh.
Probably because it's a high-energy lifestyle, being a big bear or a lion. I especially feel bad for things like lions, who are in a chronic state of malnutrition their entire lives.
Yeah, kidding me.
Who occasionally catch a critter and get full for a day or two.
I'm so full. I can't move.
Well, you look at lions. They're huge. It takes a lot of energy to walk around even.
Yeah.
Just to find a trail, and then you're stalking, and then there's the kill. Mm. And they don't have 100% kill rate.
And it's hot, man. Yeah.
So there's some critters who start out with a brain too big for their lifestyle.
Hmm.
So there. Uh-huh. So here's how this works with what I'm doing. How? I am Tell so me how. Worried this is going to be entirely incoherent. All right.
Okay.
While I was already working on kind of a quick memory system with neurons,
mm-hmm.
just playing around with the underpinnings of the system before I tried to do anything fancy,
right?
I was making a short-term memory,
mm-hmm.
which I have done, except it doesn't forget things.
Okay. Okay.
But this is how this works.
Mm-hmm.
You have clock neurons and you have word neurons.
Yes, you okay.
Let's just start with one clock neuron.
Okay.
In this system, in order to keep everything all synced up, I had to make a pretend time.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a method called tick that gets called and everything happens. And mm-hmm. then it moves on to the next tick. When there are multiple clock neurons, they go off in sequence, one after the other, one each per tick.
Oh, okay.
One clock neuron right now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
How many words you want?
Two.
Okay. Let's have two.
I was going to say, well, you threw me for a loop there. What a hard question.
The clock neuron mm-hmm. is connected to each of the word neurons.
Okay.
Via, well, it doesn't
really matter. What is happening right now? Okay.
Well, I can give you all the terms and so forth, but I think it actually confuses things.
Okay.
So it has two connections to the other two neurons.
Okay.
And those connections have a certain strength. Mm-hmm. If the clock neuron goes off, which it will in the first tick,
mm-hmm.
since there's only one, okay. both of those connections send a message.
Mm-hmm.
So both word zero and word one will get a message from the first clock neuron.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, that message is zero. It doesn't matter.
I went off, guys. Are you paying? Hey, guys.
But there's a trick, a twist, mm-hmm. a thing. Okay. If one neuron goes off, mm-hmm. fires right before another neuron,
mm-hmm.
the strength between them is strengthened slightly.
Okay.
So that the next time we go through, the first neuron will activate the second one.
Okay.
So if we say some other system, I don't know, hearing, language, imagination, makes the word neuron go off right after the first clock neuron.
Okay.
Which one? Word zero, word one goes off.
Okay.
That connection, mm-hmm. and only that connection between clock and word one is increased.
Okay.
So the next time clock fires, word one will happen.
Oh, well, good old word one. It's paying attention to the clock like a hard worker.
Yes.
Mm.
Now, if the other one went off, that connection would be increased. If they both go off in the same tick, both connections get increased. So every time you go back through and hit the clock neurons again, the pattern is repeated.
Ah, so it's like holding the memory of it.
Yes,
yeah.
Except this is a moron. We've got one clock neuron and two words. How about 50 clock neurons and 26 words?
Okay.
This is where it actually all comes together. It's an example of how I can increase in functionality. Increase in functionality.
Increase in functionality. Increase
in functionality. Just by making a couple of groups of neurons bigger.
Hmm.
Because I already wrote the program that wires them all up.
Okay.
So I don't ever have to do it again.
Well,
there are limits, right?
Well, yeah.
The other side of the story. Like if I have other systems, and I intend to hook this up to other systems,
mm-hmm.
that answer questions like, how many times did word zero happen?
Mm-hmm.
Or give me the list of what happened without, you know, doing it in the same rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If I've got 50 clock neurons to run through, that's not that big a deal.
Okay.
But if I have 50 million clock neurons to run through, we're going to start running into a little bit of trouble here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, that's the other side of the story. You can't just make it bigger. Eventually, you're going to have to reorganize everything.
I want you to do thus and so. Yeah, moron!
I hate robots. There's a whole subreddit, right? We're looking at automation,
mm-hmm.
right? By 3000 BC in Egypt,
yeah.
they already had water clocks where these little figures of guys would hit a bell with a little tiny hammer. Once on the hour, every hour. So that's pretty advanced already.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's the problem, because it's hard to find the steps that led there. By the time you hear about it, they're showing off with their flying pigeon they built out of wood and hope.
An explosion of tech all at once. Where did it start?
Yeah, so I think we'll start with some simple machines.
Okay.
Classically, there are five or six, depending upon if you ask the Greeks or the Renaissance Europeans. I'd list them, but the ones that are included change all the time.
Okay.
But let's hit a couple of these. Some of these are so simple, you're like, that's not even a machine, right? The incline plane. Also known as a ramp.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
it didn't get analyzed mathematically until the 1500s. Part of the reason being, I believe one author said, incline plane is no more a machine than a mountainside is.
There you go. I like that guy. He makes sense to me.
But, you know, if you happen to be moving a piano, which I have in my lifetime, and for some reason they've taken out the stairs and suddenly the door into the house is 8 feet up.
Yeah,
it'd be a lot easier if you had, say, a 40-foot long ramp.
Because an 8-foot long ramp isn't going to do
it. No, it's just going to sit there and mock you, lying right up against the wall. Yeah.
Looks just like the wall. Yeah,
that's the principle, right? The longer the ramp, the shallower the angle or the pitch. Depending on who you ask.
If it takes math, then it's a machine? Is that what? You got to scratch your head. Oh, we made a machine.
Yes. I don't know. That's how you use it if you're moving across of it. You can also make a smaller one and move it around.
Oh, okay.
Which we call a wedge. Another simple machine. And you can either think of it as a single inclined plane or a couple of them. Connected by a base. And it's a simple machine. Its whole mission in life is to take all the force that you put on the blunt end and focus it along the edge of the sharp end. This includes things that you wouldn't necessarily think of, oh, that's a wedge, like an axe or even a knife.
Well, now that I think of it, that's very much a wedge, an axe, yeah.
Yeah. So that makes it the oldest known tool. I told you we'd get to the Stone Age. Earliest known stone tools, they call them chopping tools. We're not quite up to the sophistication of the later hand axes. They know for certain they've been around since 2.6 million years ago.
Jeez, okay.
If you accept the evidence of maybe butchered animals, 3.9 million years ago.
Oh, evidence on the bones or something like
that? Yeah, yeah. Okay. Which, you know, might actually just be abrasive sand or they being stepped on by elephants.
They can't find the murder weapon, but that's a dead deer, yeah.
Yeah, so if you take that as one of the beginning steps, we started on the road to robotics before we were human.
Holy crap.
Had a brain about the size of a chimpanzee. It's not too surprising. Chimpanzees use tools too, you know. There's other things that confuse me about this whole step, like cutting a gear.
When
you look that up, they tell you, well, they used a gear cutting machine. Yeah. You open that up and inside of it are a bunch of gears. Or screws, high precision screws, you need for things like calipers and precision engineering. You make it on a screw lathe with a lead screw. Now, wait a minute. I need a screw to make a screw. But I did find out something about how these things got started.
Okay.
Which we're going to talk about.
Oh.
Next time. See you then.
Bye.
You sound all shocked. Yeah. We're not done.